All right, all welcome right. everyone. I'm getting a bit of an echo there. Not sure what's going on. Okay, that's a little better. Welcome everyone at Revolution Radio, and welcome everyone at truthbroadcastnetwork.com. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Sunday's Cancel the Cabal radio show. I got a little bit confused there. Still got that echo on my mind there. Welcome everyone. This is Sunday afternoon. I have a very, very special guest up today. She's a child advocate. She's the founder of FASCA, F-A-C-S-A, Family and Friends Fighting Against Child Sexual Abuse. That doesn't really spell out FASCA, but anyways, I have Connie Lee up with me. She's the founder, president of FASCA, Family and Friends Against Child Abuse, Child Sexual Abuse. They're a nonprofit group currently down in Spring Hill, Louisiana. FASCA Foundation provides support services for families of child sexual abuse, such as attorneys, counselors, support group, guidance, and what each family needs for their cases. They also educate the community on prevention of child sexual assault through their programs, such as Good Touch, Bad Touch program from Child Help USA, Kids Safe ID kits for the National Exploited Children's Foundation. Okay, I'm going to bring her up now. Welcome to the show, Connie.
Thanks, Stephen. How are you today?
Very good. Why don't you tell us a little bit more what that little introduction, that little bio doesn't say?
Well, the bio doesn't say that we're the FASCA Foundation, staff for family and friends fighting against child sexual assault. We are all volunteer staff. We've been incorporated since May 2009. We've helped families not only in Louisiana, but all across the nation. And we just, you know, we do it with passion. We don't get paid for our services. Any money that's donated goes to our families or to the Shattering the Silence tour and documentary project we just are working on since August 2012. We've helped a lot of families. We've united organizations across the nation. We've actually been trying to create a paradigm shift where people will stand up and say they will not be silent anymore. We'll help break this multi-generational epidemic. And we can do that together. And that's what we're working on.
Yes, it does. What specifically got you into this, activism?
Well,
in this field.
I was raped when I was 11 by my stepfather. We were brought up my mom was a single mom. She brought us up by herself for about 8 years. And then she married a guy that was verbally and physically abusive. He tried to kill her, and the police ended up shooting him dead. And then about a year later, she married somebody else who was made him look like a saint. And that's the stepfather that raped me. And it's just, we were just brought up in a very, a lot of times we had no food, a lot of times we were beaten, we were neglected. So you just really, we took care of each other, actually. And that's what, you know, then later on I married and I went to college. And after our divorce, I raised my children, I put us all through college. The kids are doing fine. And then I started this foundation, and I've been working with everything I have, fighting for children to provide safer environments.
Yeah, that's what that really mirrors a lot of the stories of some of the other foundation members that I have on. It's really sad that these stories are all similar. You can just write a story on paper and change names and faces. I know this is a later on question, but I won't even get to the question right now, I think, but my biggest problem with a lot of this abuse is the lack of morals in people and the lack of ethics in people anymore, all around the world. Actually, I'm in a little bit of a virtual argument with a guy on my YouTube channel on pedophilia and some of the other so-called scientific technical meanings of the different age groups of children, girls and boys, they have different definitions for different age groups and that, and that's just seems to me just to be semantics. They want to play around with words to make it substantiate it in their minds. As far as sexually abusing children, unless a child is at the age of consent, I think it should be classified as pedophilia or just molestation.
Exactly. But you know, you have a really hard time, especially advocates today. They have a hard time with the word molestation or fondling, because it eases the terminology and it makes everything, oh well, that's not too bad. But actually, it is, because it's the rape of a child. Whether they're being fondled or they're being raped or molested, it's all the same trauma. And I tell you, Dr. Rebecca Campbell conducted some research on the traumatization, the neurobiology of sexual assault, and I'll have that on one of my Facebook links. But it's basically saying, from the time a child is sexually assaulted, it alters the neural pathways of their brain, and until those, you know, they may get into self-loathing and anger and wonder what they did to cause it, or you know, what happened. But what happens is, until they work through those processes, and that may take a long time. You know, and it'll affect every relationship they ever get into. But until they work through those processes, they'll never forget it, and they'll never get over it. And many times victims hear, why don't you just forget it? Why don't you just get over it? But they don't realize. And some of them think, you know, they're moving on with their life, when really it affects the way they trust people or don't trust people. It affects who they let in their lives and continually getting into abusive relationships. And so, you know, and that's sad when people stand by and indifference.
Well, you see, I think there's a conspiracy out there myself. As most of us know, there are almost, I think it's 750,000 registered sex offenders just in America alone. That's that seems like quite a big number to me anyways, but a lot of us know that if you do open up a drawer and see one cockroach, there are always 50 to 100 that you can't see. And I'm just really worried about the unseen molesters and the unseen abusers.
Most of your readers know, and some may not, that 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 4 boys will be sexually assaulted before their 18th birthday. But the problem with that is, only 10% tell, and most of them don't, because they're still living with the perpetrator. It's usually a family member, a neighbor, a community leader. And so until they reach a safe zone, which is usually when they graduate or move on their own, or they run away from home, they won't say anything, because the perpetrator threatens their lives. They threaten the lives of their parents and their family, their siblings, their pets. They use all kinds of methods, drugs, alcohol. They sell them to their friends. They do many, many things to children to keep them shame and in degradation and silence. And it's many times you can see the warning signs. And that's what we've been trying to do across the nation by hosting the free conferences, is providing community leaders and grandparents and parents with the warning signs, safe exit plans, solutions. So if they see that, they can say, this is happening in our family, and this is what I can do. But a lot of times that's not so cut and dry, because they don't have the skills to provide for the family, or they don't want to rock the boat. And many times our judicial system is set up to protect the perpetrators and not the victims and the children.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's the next thing we were going to get into. What are some of the things that your foundation does? I know I read a little bit on the bio there, but go ahead and explain some of them things.
Okay, first and foremost, what we do is we provide pro bono attorneys and pro bono counselors for children of child sexual assault and their families. We give them guidance, resources, go to court with them, whatever they need to make it through the process, or what we have at our disposal. Then many times we provide community education and prevention. We also have a program that I designed called the FOXA Defense, and that's where we go into schools for free and we teach teenagers about abusive dating relationships, what they can do, who to call, and then we teach them 30 minutes of self-defense. hands-on that they could get involved in. And it was just basically to empower them, to let them know that they do have a voice and their voice is powerful. And a lot of times kids think what's going on at home is the norm because that's what they've always been taught. And they think it's going on in other homes and it's just a deep, dirty secret, but it's really not what's supposed to be going on at homes. And so you educate them and tell them, you don't want to put all the pressure on the children to, you know, protect themselves. You want to, that's the reason we teach grandparents and parents and community leaders to stand up and fight for children, because we've seen all across the nation that's just not what's happening. And like I said, 90% of the perpetrators are in the home and in the community. So kids do what they have to survive, and that means if not speaking about it, that's what they'll do.
Yes. I don't know, you kind of mentioned something there that brought a little scenario to my mind. I've seen some videos and seen interviews of adult survivors, I guess, if you want to call them adult victims. Well, no, yeah. Victims don't live, survivors do. So I guess it is survivors. Yes. Yeah, adult survivors. They say the same kind of phrase. I grew up thinking that this was a normal thing. I didn't really know it was bad until I was like 14 or 15. And that's the same kind of phrase that they come out with. It's they're taught at a very early age that maybe it's a game or, like you said, a grandpa, uncle, dad, brother, whoever it happens to be, the neighbor across the street. And they always seem to make it a game. And they call that grooming, don't they?
That is grooming. And a lot of times if a child suspects that this perpetrator may hurt their younger siblings, they'll try their best to take all of the rape and the degradation and the abuse and neglect, or, you know, whatever they can do. When they don't realize what's happening is he's also grooming them too. Well, he may make this one person feel very special with gifts or with attention or special outings, things like that. He's also, you know, it's like online pedophiles. They may go in and they may groom a child online and ask them to, you know, they've gained their trust and tell them nobody cares about them or loves them the way they do, and they ostracize them from their parents and their friends, and they get them to thinking that they, you know, they're the ones to rely on, when in fact, not only are they grooming this child, but they're grooming possibly 100 other children, and they're all in a network. They have a very intricate network, the perpetrators do, and they teach each other how to groom the children, how to appease the parents, and how to avoid the law. They even have like a Bible, 750 pages, you can find it on Amazon, where they teach each other all these things. It's amazing, and these kids get in it. A lot of times, even if they have families in the other room, people think it's a socioeconomic thing, status, but it's not, because rape is no discrimination of persons. It affects the rich and the poor, and the educated, the uneducated, boys and girls. It's no different persons, respective persons. But they will constantly, like water dripping on a rock, gnaw at them. It may take months. You know, it's not just something that happens overnight. They may tell them to take a shirt off or show themselves, or they get them drunk or give them alcohol and drugs, and they continue until they get what they want, and then they must start pimping them out to other people as well. So it's a slippery, slippery slope.
Yes, it is, absolutely. The Skype call-in number, if anybody wants to call in and ask a question or just talk about some things, it's 347-688-2902. That's on Studio A here. So, we'll give that a little bit, and I'll give that out a few times here during the show, and talk to Connie some more. Maybe even get some, get somebody's story out there that wants to be heard.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
We always encourage people to speak up, and there's more power in their voice, and they're not alone. A lot of times they think they're alone and they have no support, and this just happens to them and no one else, but that's not true. It happens to a lot of us across the country.
Yes, it is. And Connie is down in Louisiana. I know the station is down there in Kentucky, but we can all get connected through this virtual world here and on Skype, and maybe get somebody some help.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of help have you been able to? I'm supposing it's not just women, but men also.
It's boys as well.
Boys, yeah.
Yes, We, like I said, we provide the pro bono attorneys and counselors. And sometimes that's, especially in small communities, you find that they don't like talking about child sexual assault or rape. And it's just a dirty subject, or it's a taboo subject people don't like to deal with. And that's how it's become such a multi-generational epidemic. And it's like when, I know before we took off on our Shattering the Silence tour, we had a case where we were working on, and it was, they kept saying they were doing their best when really they were not. And so it finally, before we started the tour, they finally took on the case, and they won the case and got the help this other person needed. But it's, we found, and I thought, you know, if we're having this problem here in our little area, we have to have it all across the nation. And so we began the Shattering the Silence tour and documentary project. Now I mortgaged my house and I got a decent vehicle so I can do this tour, because it's so vital to, for prevention and education and teaching our children and our communities, you know, to speak up, to use our voice and speak up and fight for our children, to quit standing by an indifference, to not say this is, you know, to say this is not our generation, you know, and give the kids the hope they've been clinging for, you know. So that's what we've been doing for since August 2012.
Yeah, that's very good. I know I know it's a bit of a offshoot here, but back last year I had a young man and his mother on. In his case, it wasn't really about sexual abuse, but it was about abuse.
Yeah.
The parents had divorced, and the father had been the abuser, and he had claimed parental alienation syndrome, and we can get into that here in a little bit, but he ended up getting his son and was still abusing him.
Yes.
And he was 16 years old. He couldn't get away from his dad because his dad had legal rights to him.
Yes.
And what this boy ended up doing was he ended up marrying a friend of his, a girl, just for legal rights to be away from his father. He got away from his father by marrying a friend. I don't even know if they consummated the marriage or not, but they stayed together legally long enough just for him to get away from his father.
You know, and sad to say, divorce is hard enough on children, let alone parents. But when it comes down to pitting the children against one parent or the other, you're taking that side of the child and saying, that side of you is bad, you don't belong to that. Just get away from that. And so the child is confused and in a moral quandary for as long as they're alive, you know, until they resolve these issues. And so what happens is a lot of, and we see that a lot where kids, they're, you know, pulled from one parent to the other. And we've also seen cases where the child is being abused by the father. And the mother doesn't have as much money to fight legally. We mentioned about the CPS systems. And it's not just poor families, but poor families, they don't have a lot of funds to fight legally. And they take advantage of that. And parents, it could be the guy or the girl, you know, I mean, the mother or the father. So the kids, we have got to fight for our kids. We've got to educate and prevent. That's the judicial systems, the education systems. Everybody needs to be caught up on what's really happening and the warning signs and solutions. Because I promise you, you know, people say they don't see, they look away in a difference and they don't see all the abuse that's going on around them, but they actually do. You see it with the school shootings. You see it with the violence in our communities, with the children. You see it. You just choose not to see it.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned parental alienation syndrome. I myself personally, I don't know all about it. You know, I just know that there's a way that an abuser can get their victim. You want to
expand on that?
Yeah, talk about parental alienation syndrome, how it started, and
okay, well. I don't know. I can't tell you how it started, but I can tell you what it affects. There's almost like a term called gaslighting. Whenever someone's in an abusive relationship, a gaslighting is saying, and they can do it with just by themselves, or they can do it with friends and family, because a lot of times abuse and neglect and sexual assault runs in families. And so it usually happens within a family. And what they'll do is the person that they're pitting against, or, you know, trying to parental alienation against. They will make them think that things have been moved, that they moved them, and they just don't remember, or they're crazy, that it happened. It's just like when you're in an abusive relationship, the abuser tries to think you didn't see what you see, you saw, and you can't believe your own self, and you start doubting yourself, and you wonder, even though you've given your best, what is it? Maybe something I'm doing. And so that erodes their self-esteem, and sometimes they can lose their mind, and sometimes it takes them a long time to get out of that, you know. And many times an abuser will, especially, it's very dangerous if a person says, I'm going to leave this abuser and I'm going to take my children, because that's when the abuser is most dangerous. And that's when we recommend that always get a buddy system. And if you leave, make sure you change your passwords and protect yourself, and follow a court order injunction of protection order. At least it'll be some record. Get documents. We always say to get a safe bag if you ever decide to leave. A safe bag, and you keep it in your house until you decide to leave, with kids' toys, medical records, dental records, driver's license, insurances, bank statements, any school records, anything you need. So when at that time, when you feel like you can or you want to, you do leave. But also erase any, like if you're looking for a place to stay, erase that off your internet, or erase the last call or something like that. But we do recommend a buddy system. You can also like put a light on, or put a plant in the window and take it down, or turn it off whenever you're in trouble. There's many aspects of things you can do like that to warn people who love you that there is danger, because they are the abuser's most dangerous whenever he thinks you're going to leave. But parental alienation, that can also happen when children are adults, let alone when the kids are younger. And I know I have many friends that are that is happening with their abusive ex-spouse, and the kids, they'll go over to this place and they either won't let them call their mom, or they're always trying to portray mother or dad as the bad person, and that's hurting the kids so badly. And they'll grow up and they'll resent that. I mean, and there's times, yeah.
Absolutely, they will. Yeah, I just wanted to give my own little input on that. No, that's okay. I was 8 years old when my parents divorced, and my mother was good about it. She never talked bad about my father, but my father was the one that tried to poison me and my brother against my mother. Yeah. And I lost a lot of respect for him for that. I lost a lot of love for him for doing that. And he would say some very nasty things and try to, I don't know, he didn't want possession of me and my brother, but he just wanted our adulation or admiration or something. He just wanted more love than what we were giving him every other week. Every other weekend.
So how did that affect your relationships?
I didn't really see him for quite a few years until after I got out of high school and that. I don't know. Not very often, for 5 or 6 years probably.
How did that affect your relationships with women? Your partner.
Oh, I have a lot more respect for women than a lot of men do. I don't know. I certainly don't treat women like I see a lot of men treat women.
Yeah.
But
see, it does. It spills over into adulthood. It's very sad.
So why do you ask that, though?
Oh, I ask because it does affect, especially it jades some men toward women, and it jades some women toward men. You know, and like I said, it affects over to, you know, who they trust. If they're promiscuous, if they use people, or if they, you know, lie and manipulate, it carries on and on. And you know, there's many things I've learned, especially coming out of abusive marriage. It was like, you can't love enough for two, and you can't make it work by yourself. And you really have to come to a point where you say it's okay to love again, and it's okay to trust again. But you have to be careful who you trust, and be more careful who you give your heart to.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. I can't really say some of the things he told me on air, but you know, they were pretty bad, and I didn't really like him at the time that he said it, and I kind of resented him for many years, and he's been gone since 2008. I don't know whether I made a mistake, but I did take care of him the last 10 years of his life. Had him with me in my home and that, and that was a nightmare also. He never really tried to make up, but he only apologized maybe twice in that 10 years, and he would always say something like, if you apologize, you're showing weakness in that. And
oh, wow.
I didn't really get that until.
But you know, Stephen, that attests to your character, not his. That attests to the kind of man that you are, that you're big enough to know and comfortable in your skin to know where you stand and your boundaries. And that you're giving and caring enough to do that, even though this person may not have been the best to you.
Oh, certainly, certainly, yeah. Yeah, if I wasn't caring enough, I wouldn't even be doing this. So there's a lot of other things that are a lot more fun than trying to fight this child abuse and that.
Yes, but it's a worthy cause, and the kids are counting on us.
They really are. Yes, they are. I mention it a lot on most of my shows. We're not really raising the children. We're raising adults, and we are. How they are raised affects them every single day, every single word. People don't realize that, you know, the word stupid, what that can do on a child, what that can do to a child, ugly, fat. All of us know the words. I don't really think that old saying, sticks and stones might break my bones, but names can never hurt me, or something like that. I don't think that reigns true for me. Seriously, don't.
That doesn't reign true for you or a lot of people, especially children, because they're looking up to you. You're the whole world to them. And for you to say that they're not worthy with those words, you don't come out and say, but that's the bottom line that they're receiving, is that they're not loved enough. There's nothing, and they try to please as much as they can. And they continue to get abused either through verbal communication or physical or sexual assault. And it takes you a long time to get to the fact that it says, that was not my fault. But at that time, a child believes that that's their fault. And so they get angry, and they may try to commit suicide. They may get into cutting. They may get into drugs, anything to numb the pain that they've had to deal with at home.
Yeah, well, mine wasn't so much drugs. It was probably alcohol when I was a teen. I did abuse that. I always tried to stay away from the drugs.
Yeah.
I don't know why I didn't. I seriously do not know to this day why I did not get into the drugs. They were plenty of opportunities, and I had plenty of friends that did them and wanted me to do them with them, but I just don't know.
Well, you just knew that wasn't for you.
Yeah. Yeah, but the alcohol didn't do me any good either. But I know some people, a lot of kids really can't handle it. Do you know how many take their lives or do these things, cutting or acting out sexually? Or
no, I don't have the stats per se, but most kids that are sexually abused will try to deal with it in their own manner, in their own way, especially whenever this is still happening and like the mother's looking away or allowing this to happen, or they're passing them out to their friends, or it continues to go on and on. So they're portraying to the world that they're a good family, but yet at home behind closed doors all these horrific things are happening. So the child is in constant conflict with themselves or who they are, what they're being told, what's being betrayed, and it's this, a lot of kids can't handle that. That's the reason they go into numbing. And as you talk about alcohol and drugs and sex, it also is overeating, overworking. I know I put myself under my work all the time, and that's how I deal. But you learn that you can run, but you can't hide. So eventually you're going to have to break that down. You're going to have to reach it in your heart and deal with those ugly issues. And it's painful. But you come out on the other side, you're better for it, you're stronger for it, and you're more wiser for it. And if you're going to get into a healthy relationship, that's the process you're going to have to get involved in.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I think, I wonder if being molested as a child is I don't want to say a good thing, but Do you think it was a thing that I'm not even sure where I'm going to go with this question, Connie. I know most of the people that I've had on have been molested, and they're all advocates. Do you think a lot of people are drawn towards advocacy? That
actually, most people are drawn to the fact that they're trying to help other kids not endure the pain that they've had to do. I wouldn't say it's a good thing, but to not take the tragedy and make something good out of that, to teach others and to empower other victims to speak up and know that they're not alone, and they do matter, and their voice does matter, and that they're loved and accepted just as they are, because we're not perfect. All of us have our faults and our flaws, and you've just got to find the people who accept you and love you as you are. And those who are criticizing you, and especially a lot of families, will ostracize survivors for talking because they don't like the truth being exposed. They don't like it publicly hurting their reputation or their social status.
Is it a family taboo thing?
Most of the time, yes, it is. And then at times on the holidays, victims and survivors and thrivers, they're alone a lot because they can't, or they may go home. Some do, some still do, some still play their roles. But most of the time, survivors choose not to go home. They choose not to step into that because they're expected to be quiet and say nothing. And they're to the point where victims say, you know, I matter, and I'm not going to sit there and be quiet anymore, and I am going to speak my truth. And it's my truth, and it's my life, and I can say what I want.
Yes. Yes. I think a lot of people that have been survivors of a molestation can see someone who looks at them and knows what their story is, and you know, you can probably see what that look is. There's just a look of stigmatism.
Yes, I tell you what, in children especially, they have this hollow look about them. It's like you can see right through the depths of the soul. You can see their pain, and you know that they're dealing with some kind of trauma at home, especially in classes. If you see children who are drawing real dark outside of the lines, and they'll do the pictures with no ears, no means nobody's listening. You know, you listen to a lot of what kids, communication is nonverbal 80%. The rest is 20%. So you have to put the whole story into context when you're talking to someone or when you're watching children. You can't just pick at this and say, because I tell you what, some of the warning signs of child sexual assault, where they may become isolated, they may spend a lot of time in the room on the computer, or they may try cutting or drugs, and a lot of that could be because they're into drugs and into gang, and not because they've been sexually assaulted. But usually gang activity is prostitution, and they're passed around, and they're sold. So it ties hand in hand. A lot of the runaway, well, 40, I think it's 43-45% of the runaways were because they were molested at home, and that's how they ended up on the streets. And the pimps on the streets, they recognize them because they get this huge bag with all the belongings, and they know if that's somebody who just came from home, and they're needing shelter, and they're needing a place to stay, and they'll be all nice and give them the food they need and the shelter and a warm, safe place to stay. Then
and
they'll
attention.
Tell them, you owe
yeah.
me.
Yeah. 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 I think I've heard that a lot of boys that get molested as children, a lot of them end up gay or bisexual, don't they?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot of the best. That's boys.
Well, some boys do.
Yes, boys and girls.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Girls end up turning to lesbianism, do they?
Sometimes, and I wouldn't say it's just because they've been traumatized. You know, some of them feel like they're born that way, and sometimes it's genetics where they have more of a woman's chromosome in the male body or more of a man chromosome in the woman's body. Sometimes it is because of sexual assault, because they feel like they've been betrayed by the opposite peer, person, so
yeah.
They feel more comfortable there.
Yeah. I know a lot of children act out sexually.
Yes, they do.
Why is that? What's the theory behind that?
Well, the theory is they're reenacting. Well, young children, they'll try to explore themselves, and that's natural because that's just being a child. But whenever they're doing sexually explicit things like sticking toys up their pajamas, or they're playing with themselves, or they're trying to do sexually explicit activities, you know there's more going on. And a lot of times they're trying to tell you. That's the only way they can tell you. And most people are saying, oh, that's nothing. Or they don't want to deal with it. And so they let this happen, and they let the child keep going over to the abuse of their grandpa or the whatever, and they let them spend the night, and everything's all good. Until the child one day says, hey, or they get caught doing this act, or you know, doing something to somebody else at school.
Yeah, I just caught a video a few days ago. It was going around Facebook. I think this mother caught her daughter doing something. She was singing in the back seat. She was in her little in her child carrying seat in the back of her car, and she was doing some sexual things with her fingers. And the mother was wasn't prompting her. She was asking her to explain why she was doing these things and explain who taught her these things. And I think it was ended up being her dad or her grandfather or something. And
yes.
I'd like to find out what's going on with that woman there. But yeah, it's the acting out sexually can be a maybe a cry out for help.
It is a cry out for help. But see, they're just doing what they're naturally taught. And like say you said, it's a game or our little secret and things like that, and that's what they believe. They're just being a child. They're just living out naturally what they've been taught. Children didn't come to this world to hate and to know all these things. They're taught these things, and it's and that's the reason it's our job to step up and protect our children a lot better than what we've been doing.
Yes, absolutely. I know we need a lot more voices out there on this issue.
Hey, while we're on the subject, I'd like to say, if somebody thinks their child is being sexually assaulted, they can call 1-800-4-A-CHILD, which is the hotline for child abuse. But some of the signs are them playing with themselves or doing these explicit things. Other signs would be like they're having nightmares or they're having terrors or they're afraid of being around a certain place or a certain person or certain things. And sometimes they can tell you and sometimes they can't, but you really need to watch those verbal cues. And a lot of times, don't shrug it off because you think you know this person. They would never do anything like that. You listen to that child, because that child's telling you the truth in most cases. It's very seldom that that child will tell you a lie. And those cases are usually discounted. Most of these cases where the child is saying something, that's very true. And if you're going to be a contributor, you're going to either stand by and let this happen, or you're going to stand by and fight for your child. And I promise you, I went all across this country between August 2012 until February this last year. The two questions that haunt survivors all across this nation, whether they be small children or old men, old women, the two questions are, why didn't somebody stand up, fight for me, and say something? And why didn't somebody protect me? And despite all the horrific things, and there's been so many horrific things that they went through, those are the two questions that haunt their lives still today.
What are some of the excuses that survivors get?
A lot of times, they don't give them an excuse, or they just tell them, you know, the parent will look away and allow this to happen. Or and we've caught that on many, many occasions where the parent just didn't say anything, and they knew the uncle was coming upstairs molesting them at a young age, or they knew the dad was coming into the room at night, but nobody said anything. Nobody protected them. The mother had, or whoever was there, had no other way of providing for that family, no other resources financially or another place to go, and they chose to allow these things to happen by their silence. And whenever you sit by in silence, whether it's in a community or at home, that's aligning with the perpetrator, saying it's okay, you go ahead and do what you want to because you have money or you have power and you have status.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's fear, I think, a lot of times. I don't know. Fear from the child, as you mentioned earlier, being killed, or little brother being killed, little sister being killed. I'll kill mommy if you tell anybody, or, you know, that makes a very, very strong psychological imprint on someone.
Well, I know my stepfather, whenever he was beating on the door of my bedroom, and he wanted to rape me, and I knew what he was going to do because I heard him locking all the doors when my mom left. So I locked my bedroom door, and whenever he came to the door, and he said, if you don't open this door, you know what I'll do. I'll kill you and your mother both. And I knew he was very capable, and I knew he could do it, and no one would find us. So I opened the door, and that's what happened. And so it's something you have to live with, and you have to become the best you can be and provide resources and fight for kids.
Yeah. Sounds like you got a ruckus in the background there, huh?
Probably the dogs at the door. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Don't worry about it. It's a little funny. I'm not sure where else to go. What's the solution here?
See, we talked about that the other night.
Yeah.
Solutions would be education and prevention. Honestly, that's educating the judges, educating the police and law enforcement, EMS, all these people. It's like Dr. Rebecca Campbell was saying, a lot of times when victims go to the police station and to report a rape, what happens is the policeman will say, well, you're backtracking, or you're not telling the complete story, you must be lying to us. But that person is so traumatized. It's like having a bunch of little different post-it notes, all different colors, all shapes and sizes, stuffed under shoes, and a bra, and a purse, and a handbag, and she's trying to piece the story together, because when she's sexually assaulted, or he was sexually assaulted, you kind of disassociate from yourself and to go through that pain, and so your mind kind of alters, so you can endure what's happening to you. And so whenever they go to the police station and they're trying to tell this story, they don't have all the pieces themselves. And even when law enforcement have a shooting incident in their police department, they'll give this police officer 48 hours to get their thoughts together. But they don't do that for victims. And they'll say, oh, you must be lying, we're going to close the case, and that's the end. So a lot of times they're re-victimized all over again. And it's like...
Are you okay, Connie?
Oh, yeah, I'm fine.
Oh, okay. Okay, you just... You sound like a little bit like you're breaking up, maybe, but...
Okay. I just get I just get very passionate about this because, you know, it's...
Well,
we need an army.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. If we can save one child, it always makes me feel good when I have somebody come back to me and say, thank you for getting my story out there. You know, I just...
Exactly.
Nobody listens.
Yes.
People need to listen more. I think a lot of the time people get this feeling that if it's not happening to them and their family, they don't want to hear it.
Yeah, but you know what? They pay through it. They say, people say, well, I'm not going to get involved. It doesn't affect me. But actually, it does affect you, because you pay for it through the taxes. When a child's sexually assaulted, it affects their grades, and their education system may start failing because they can't focus. Then they may become promiscuous and then become pregnant, which they'll affect the welfare system. And then it also, if they get into drugs and alcohol, it could affect the judicial system and the mental health system whenever they start trying to commit suicide or cutting themselves. So it affects, you pay for it all through your taxes. So you can't say it doesn't affect, it affects everyone.
Yeah, that's what we got into the other day, Connie. It affects every aspect of
our society.
Of society. Somebody who isn't good on the who isn't good to themselves or good to others is going to be a burden to the system, whether they're a drug abuser or alcoholic or in jail or causing more abuse to others.
You know, Stephen, a lot of times as children, even as adults, you wonder why. You know, we asked about the two questions a while ago, but a lot of times our parents were teaching what they've been taught, what they knew, and that was all they were surviving as well. No one ever gave them the tools and the resources, and so they were passing on their knowledge and expertise, you know, whatever, it being abuse or you can always tell. I conducted my psychological research in college on why we fall in love with who we do, and it basically boils down to this: when we're children, we watch how our parents interact with one another, whether they be loving and caring and giving, or they're abusive and they lie to each other, or they're evasive or they cheat on each other, and that becomes your comfort zone. And what happens is whenever you start developing relationships when you're in high school, you say, I'll never be like my mother and I'll never be like my father. But what happens is that turns out to be the case, because subconsciously that's your comfort zone and that's what you're looking for. And that's how it becomes a multi-generational epidemic. And it's not until you receive counseling and realize there is a problem, because I know most people say, hey, I'm fine. But it's when it affects their relationships, that's when they decide to get the help.
Yeah, yeah. I've also cut another video a couple of times. I should be saving these things and talking about them, but the video is kind of like a PSA, public service announcement, and what they show is... adults abusing themselves, whether it be with alcohol or drugs or road rage. And they have a child in this little PSA doing the same thing right next to the adult.
Oh, I've seen that. That's
yes,
very,
you have.
Yeah, profound. Very profound.
And, well, we still have to go back to... Sorry there. Had somebody tell me something. Yeah, we still have to go back to, we're not raising children. We're raising adults. We're raising them and how they need to be or how we want them to be. And if we're abusing them, we're showing them that it's almost okay.
That is true. Because children are going to listen more to what you do than what you say. And, you know, I have this really problem with schools who teach children that expect children to come in and sit down for hours and hours on end, and they're children, and they teach them, they're trying to teach them as adults. And I know that teachers are short-staffed. I know they don't have a lot of teachers' aides in the rooms, and the children are not getting the help they need for their education or the tutoring they need for problems. But a lot of times when they say we want a drug-free school, they turn around and they push Ritalin on children who can't sit still and can't listen for those long hours of time. They, you know, they're overlooking the fact that children all learn on different levels, and they all, their boys learn differently from girls. And I know they don't have time to deal with that. They have to go and sit in with the structure and do what they can. But, you know, continually drugging children for many years, and then whenever they get 18, they're going to have to find something to sustain that level of calm for their lives. And so while you say you don't want drugs in school, that's exactly what you're perpetuating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of things on these. I've been doing a lot of research on some of these drugs, too. I've been doing some shows on them. They're not the greatest things in the world. They cause people to do a lot of bad things that they wouldn't even think about doing if they weren't on these drugs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what would you like to talk to? What would you like to talk to about the last 5 or 6 minutes here that we have?
Okay, I would like to talk just a couple minutes. We have a phenomenal program called Shatter the Silence. And if you'd like to be a part of our program, please go to foxafoundation.org or call me at 318-540-4464. And I think Stephen will provide a link. But also I'd like to say, whenever you call, if you suspect child abuse, you know, whether you're right or wrong, you still need to call. But, you know, you have to be careful with that, because there is a lot of corruption in our CPS system. And the states get lots of money per diem for the children that are taken from homes and adopted out. And you can tell by our judicial systems, I mean, not our judicial system, but our penal systems, which are now big business. And it's big business to take children who are accounted for crimes as an adult, because they're getting free labor. As a matter of fact, according to some of our stats, there's a, I'm trying to think of, find this name, but it was education. This, okay, according to the NCCAN, National Center on Child Abuse and Neglect, it was talking about the kids that were removed and put into the penal systems. You can go to allgov.com, and there's thing called the Corrections Corporation of America, which agreed to bribe prisons from 48 states as long as lawmakers provide them with 90% occupancy. And so we have to really be careful what we're taking away, get kids from homes that where some intervention could have been made instead of taking them and putting them to be perpetuated against on a larger scale.
Yeah, that's something I totally forgot about. We could have, we still can. we do have another hour. We could talk about the family court, the family court injustice. We can talk about, I don't know, it's up to you. You want to come back some more after the break? Or?
Let's take a quick break and then we'll cover a little more.
Well, we still got about 4 or 5 minutes until our actual scheduled break. It's at B356 our time here, so. Yeah, we still got about 3 minutes until that break.
Okay. I'll carry on with this, what I was saying. With the CPS corruption, according to the NCCAN, it's 18% of children were removed from unsubstantiated reports of child abuse. and Pennsylvania, Kansas, and New Jersey led the 16-state reporting and half placed in foster care, where the stats say they didn't show that there is any difference in the unreported stats, but the kids were taken away from homes to be abused and trafficked in foster care system. They were 11 times more likely to be sexually assaulted.
11 times more?
Yep.
In foster care?
Yep.
Yeah. I know this. The statistics just skyrocket for the children that are in foster care. Just the bad things that can happen to them. Drug abuse. I know a couple of years back there was a case of a woman somewhere. I wish I could remember where she was. She fought the CPS to try to keep her little girl, 8 or 9 year old girl or something, and CPS took her, and she got molested, and she got an STD. She got some kind of a... I don't know what it was. Well, I don't even really know if they specified. They just said it was an STD, yeah. some kind of sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah, because she's a minor. They're not going to tell you that.
Yes, right. They're not going to tell you any kind of particulars, right? Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to wait until like I said, we got about 2 minutes till the break here, but the family court. I hear a lot of cases. I've had a lot of stories come across to me. I've got 4 networks I do shows on, and it seems like one of my networks was almost specifically being the family court. And just the injustices.
Do you know that every case that's open in front of somebody in the CPS system and they're fighting against a child, it says the CPS reaps stipends and the law gives the legal standing to the foster parents but not to the grandparents of family or relatives that are fighting for those kids. And because there's such a strong financial incentives, it increases the adoption practitioners may be compromised ethically because if they're required to work for reunification of these families and the adoptive placement simultaneously, it gets them in a quandary of, you know, who to fight for and, you know, where the, you know, whether to take money or where to fight for children.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we are just about up on our break here, and we're going to have about a good 7.5 minutes here, Connie, so...
Thank you.
You can, and there's my music right there.
All right. Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah, we'll be back in about 7.5 to 8 minutes, everyone. We'll continue on a little more. All right, welcome back, everyone. We're continuing on with Connie Lee of FACS. I'm sorry, FACSA Foundation. I don't really talk about it a lot, Connie, but how does somebody find out if they were abused when they were a child? I just have little glimpses, just little things that flash in there, but I never really had any definite memories or anything like that.
Okay, can I ask how old you are, or can you tell me that online, on the air?
Sure, I can tell you. I just turned 50.
Okay, well, the reason I say that is, especially when children who are young or traumatized, they may not remember until their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And that's when, especially when they start developing relationships of their own, and the trust issues, like I said, come into play. That's when their mind starts feeling safe, and they start receiving those little flashbacks and those glimpses, or they're triggered by smells or certain places or certain people. You can tell you've been abused. A lot of times people remember, but when they don't remember, you do have recollections like that. And sometimes there's false memories implanted. Like if a child has been molested by their father or grandparent and they've been around him all their life, they may tell the child that was somebody else, or what you think that was, it's not what happened. You know, the child will believe that. So a lot of times when they go to therapy, they can do hypnosis and put them under, but a lot of times what they'll find is that they have to dig through a lot of those false memories before they can actually come to the truth. So a lot of times they may think that something else happened when it did not. And that's the reason a lot of times whenever these cases go to court and the victims are of age and they're trying to fight for justice, they're also going to have to deal with false memories. And so that may hurt their case, and you know, and some, unless they got an STD from their parent or something happened, or they have concrete proof. So you have to, that's going to depend on the therapist, and that's going to depend on the judicial system you have that's going to be fighting for you. But how do you tell if you've been abused? If you don't recall, if you have symptoms like that, you really do need to seek help to weed through those thought processes and see what's going on.
Yeah, well, the two specific cases, the two memories I have are of older female cousins, actually.
Yeah.
People I, you know, supposedly was to be able to trust, but now I'm not so sure, you know. I just not sure what I should do, or even if I should try to bring these things out, or.
Well, especially as men, because men are told to man up and to expect things like that and not to say anything, don't be a wimp and so forth. So they don't talk a lot. And whenever they do, it's like an iceberg. They may tell you a little bit, but there's so much more going on underneath that. And it's you can't say that it doesn't matter, because that even that kind of trauma, that's like fondling or molestation I was talking about earlier, that still affects you the same as if you were penetrated. So you can't say that it doesn't bother you, because if you wouldn't have mentioned it, if it didn't bother you.
Yeah. I don't really know whether it was just a fondling or what. I really can't tell you, because I just have a couple flashes and that's about it. But
you know, we were talking earlier about stats. You can go to the Department of Justice, to DOJ.gov, and you can get a lot of these stats that I've been mentioning on their website.
Yeah, and that leads us into the to the next category. I don't know if it's a category or not, but family court.
Yes.
What seems to be going on there?
Well, see, there's a lot going on in family court, all the way from corruption to things being in family court that has no business being in family court. Because like the rape of a child, why does that have to be in family court? Why shouldn't that be a criminal case?
Well, yeah, look at it. You can rape an 18-year-old girl, and that goes into criminal court.
Exactly.
But you rape any girl younger than 18, younger than 18, it goes into family court, doesn't it?
It does. And don't you think that terminology should be changed from molestation to rape? It's actually rape of a child.
Certainly it is. Certainly it is. Do you know some of these definitions I was talking about earlier with this guy I'm having an argument with on YouTube? Some of these different categorizations of
pedophilia.
And, hebephilia or something like that, or.
No, I'm not. I'm not familiar. Well, I've read up on it, but don't quote me on that, because I can't tell you. Pedophilia is like the longing and lingering for somebody that's very, very young. And the hyperphilia, I think that's even younger. I'm not sure. I can't tell you all those stats.
Yeah,
and I should be
I can't
able
either.
To tell you all that.
I can't either. I don't know.
But I would like to touch on that right quick while you're talking about that. What happens is people don't understand why somebody, a grown man or a grown woman, would be attracted to a young child. And a lot of that, they say, is a power thing. And that has nothing to do with sex. It's all about power and control. But it does have something to do with sex, because sexual desire is there. But the thing is, they have a hard time dealing with adult relationships. And so it's easier to control and manipulate a child and to use that and get the gratifications and the self-esteem built up and the love and the affection they think. A child can be playing and they'll say, well, she taunted me, she raised her dress at me, or she licked her lips or something like that. Anything, just absurd things that you would never think of. They think those are come-ons, and they think this child is coming onto them. And a lot of times they're trying to, even today, they're trying to change where pornography is okay, or relations with children are okay as long as they're consensual. Well, a child under age 18 is not consenting. And you can manipulate them and use them, but that's not consenting. And so it comes into so many gray areas where there people are trying to legalize prostitution or legalize pedophilia, and saying that it would be, especially over in Russia, they were saying that it would be better to have prostitution free and people wouldn't be trying to buy women so much. But that's not the case. They're doing that anyway, and they've been doing that from the dawn of time.
Not so much women, but girls.
Young girls. And the thing about that is people don't realize pedophiles, they prey upon babies. I mean, so how does a child or a baby come on to you and make you want and desire them? They don't. It's your own desires. And I've known organizations, they cater to healing the sexual offender as well as the victim of abuse. And I can promise you right now, Stephen, any resources, funds we get will go to children. We don't cater to sexual offenders. I think all of our, we have very short funds, and they're strictly for our families. And we just don't believe in that. There's a high recidivism rate, and the desire is always there. It's like a drug. And, you know, we're just not going to go there. But what they think is that the pedophile thinks that it's okay, that they're teaching them to love, and they're teaching them how to perform for others when they get orders. And they think they're doing a service to these kids.
Well, you happen to mention a power thing. It's a power trip thing. But there's a man out there that has the idea that it could be a demonic like possession that takes over people, and these demons are the ones that want to prey upon the essence of a child.
Of innocence. The essence of innocence.
Yes.
And all things good of family. I am a spiritual person. I don't believe, and I don't know how your show feels, and you can edit this part out.
Go for it. We're all God-fearers.
Okay. This is what I think. I think people are tired of religiosity. They're tired of the conformity of churches and the strict rules and regulations when they go in and they're criticized and judged when they're sitting in their seats and they have their own demons to adhere to. I think people need to see a God that says he's my solace at night, he's my one true constant companion when people come in and out of my life, and he's the lover of my soul. They want to see that kind of spiritual relationship. That's what people are longing for and hoping for. And if they're not wanting somebody to judge them and criticize them, because you hear a lot about John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, but you don't hear a lot about John 3:17, where it came to not to condemn and to criticize and judge the world, but to save it. And that's what our job is, to bring people home, not to judge and criticize them, because we all have faults and we all have sins. Our job is to do our best in bringing people home.
Yes, it is. And it's also our job to be good role models to children.
Yes, it is.
I do know. Well, sometimes children that are molested, they end up being molesters when they get older.
Yes, they do. A lot of times, like I said, that's how it becomes a multi-generational epidemic, because they learn those behaviors from their parents, and that's their norm. And until they've been taught otherwise. And that's the reason it's so important for children to have mentors and to have community leaders who are fighting for children to say, hey, this is not how it's supposed to be. You know, and to give them the warning signs and solutions and safe exit plans, so they can see their behavior is coming from the wrong side of the track, so you'd say. But that's not the correct word to say it, but it does take a lot of us to, because sometimes they're not at the point in their life where they're ready to listen to that. And that's even with as much education and prevention as we do, even our community, sometimes people are just not ready to hear that.
No, they're not. Well, I know the American people, we're being bombarded at every single degree of the 360-degree circle, you know. We have all kinds of things that we have to deal with, but I think our children's future is got to be way up there on the list.
Well, that's not just our children's future, that's our future as well, because they will be taking care of us or not.
Yes, they will, or not. Yeah, that's the idea. Some of these kids you see today, you wonder if they're... I wonder if I even want to get much older than... You know, I wonder if I actually want to get old, and maybe I'll just... I don't know. I'm not going to say I'm going to take my life, but maybe I won't stop it. Let's put it that way.
We see kids who have a lot of tattoos or a lot of big piercings where they're stretching out their ears or having these nose tattoos or their skin or their teeth are showing. Have you seen those kind of tattoos? But And people commented about it, and I just look at them and these kids are hurting and they're looking for hope.
Well, yeah. I wonder if it's a pain, or I wonder if it's just a fad. But
well, a lot of times, especially with cutting and with piercings or tattoos, people are trying to mask the pain on the outside. It makes them feel alive. It makes them feel like, because they're so numb on the inside, and so as the greater and the deeper, the more in depth the pain is on the inside, the more tattoos and the more piercings and the more cuttings you'll see.
Yeah. Let's get more into the family court.
Okay.
Let's talk about the corruption. I know it's rampant out there.
Yes, it is.
The junk science. We talked about PAS earlier. Yep. Parental alienation syndrome. Mm-hmm. As far as many are concerned, it is junk science. I know that the court system, the judges, I don't know whether it's just corrupt or whether they're just ignorant.
Probably a little of both.
Really?
It's a system where if I allow you to do this, I can do this. Or maybe I'm getting part of the piece of pie and so, you know, we're all in this together. Or sometimes when you can't beat the system, you join it. But occasionally, do you remember Judge Joe Brown? He just got into a lot of trouble for the same situation here where he was fighting against this other judge in another court, and because he was tired of children who were being sentenced as adults and they were being sentenced to jails, and that's because they want their jails full of people for free labor.
Certainly. Yeah, no, I hadn't heard about Judge Joe Brown. He was one of the TV judges, wasn't he?
That's correct. But it's about a month and a half ago. You can look it up online.
Has it really?
Mm-hmm.
He's fighting what, a higher superior court judge or something? Or?
Well, no, he went to present as, I don't know if as an attorney or just being there for a family. And he went because there was so much corruption in the system, like you said. And so he went to provide support to this family and what was happening. He got into this argument with this judge because he saw the corruption the judge was doing. And a lot of times the judge is sentencing children that shouldn't be sentenced so they can fill these prisons, and they're getting cash back. They're called cashback kids program. And so you have to and so he stood up and he was fighting for that, and they got him in a lot of trouble.
Cashback kids program.
Yep.
What does that mean?
It's kids for cash program. It deals with the death of the corruption of the Corrections Corporation of America, where they agreed, I told you this, they agreed to buy 48 of the state's prison systems as long as the lawmakers provided 90% of the accuracy.
Like, private owners, right?
Yeah. The Robert Mercial builders of Pennsylvania Western, with a child care juvenile system. The judge convicted there was on 12 counts of racketeering, money laundering, mail fraud, malfeasance of office, tax evasion, and ordered to repay $1.2 million in restitution because he was denied constitutional rights of 5,000 juveniles between 2003 and 2008.
Huh. Okay. Yeah. That's pretty wild.
And we were talking about, well, see, and they're filling these, they're getting free labor. And so if they get the kids younger, they can work longer, work harder. So
it's almost free. And yeah. aren't these inmates getting paid like 40 cents an hour or something like that, or 20?
Well, I don't know how much they get paid, but they're getting a lot of money for these kids.
Yeah.
It's just like that. And I'm going to jump back to the CPS system. I think this was for San Francisco where these stats came from, but it was like for each child that they took from this home, whether it be substantiated reports or not, it was like $30,000 per child. And then unless the child has special needs, it could have been $40,000 to $150,000. Now, foster parents would receive on average $3,000 to $8,300 a year, which makes millions of dollars of profit. And that was according to Georgia Hack of the Yahoo Contributor Network. You're looking at see, it's a big incentive not to return children and to adopt them out.
Well, they don't even have it. I'm sorry, they don't even have any incentive to get the child back to their parent or parents.
Exactly. That's the reason that a lot of times the rights of the parents or the grandparents or the family is not extended, but it's extended to the foster parents. And so we as people have to fight for our children against the judicial system. You know, it's like you don't want to buck the system, but you don't want to, it comes to a point where you have to fight for what you believe in.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been told by other guests, Connie, that a particular CPS organization might get anywhere between, I think it's $3,000 and $8,000 a month just for each child that they have fostered out.
Yes. Yep. And there's thousands of children in the foster care system.
Probably hundreds of thousands of children, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a big criminal organization, as far as I'm concerned there.
Now, I know here locally that the CPS that I've dealt with, I know in a couple of cases where the reports that, like, the parents who were concerned that the abuse was going on and tried to report it, they would question, like, who are you to report it? And you say, well, I'm a mandated reporter. Well, show your credentials. So you'd have to show your credentials. Or if there was another parent and they're trying to tell them, hey, this is going on, they say, oh, we don't have the funds to investigate that. That would have to belong to somebody else, and they would drop the case. If they don't see that they're going to be able to get that, I wouldn't say for a fact, but I think it's because if they see they're not going to be able to take that child out of that home, they just give up and they don't give a crap.
Yeah, and I think some of the silly little reasons why they investigate parents to begin with, I can understand hardcore drug abuse, but there are lots of parents that just be smoking pot or something, and they'll be arrested, and the kids will be taken. You know, pot is still illegal. I mean, until they legalize it, which is, I hope they would do soon. Because it's basically a, I don't know, for the most part, a victimless crime.
But they take these kids from the homes where they're not perfect parents, and we've all made mistakes as parents. It doesn't come
nobody's perfect, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't come with the manual. We have to fly it on the learn it on the fly. But the thing is, we do the best we can, and most parents are really good parents. Now, you do have some idiots who are abusive kids and burn them and bake them and bury them and kill them, and those are the ones you really have to worry about. But when you're taking kids from good homes and putting them in foster care where they're being sexually assaulted, or they're being trafficked, human trafficked, and prostituted. Did you know that the United States produces 50% of all global porn? And that's according to Laura Hassner from American University. That's using our children. That's using from community leaders or parents or grandparents who are using their kids to for porn or to the boyfriend or to the girlfriend, or they're passing their children on to their club members or their family. That's a lot. And it's, people think of human trafficking as something happening overseas, when actually it happens here in the United States more than you realize.
Yes, it does. And it's just 50%. I thought it was a lot higher than that.
That's just the global porn. That's not the human trafficking.
Right.
Human trafficking is a $32 billion profit industry. So, yeah.
Explain human trafficking a little bit more.
See, human trafficking, that could be like a mother has a daughter, and a lot of pedophiles will target single women because they're in need. They'll give them services of fixing something around the house, or babysitting services, or money, or things like that, and they'll go in and they'll take these children and they'll rape them, or they may even marry the mom to have access to the children. But then they'll also pimp them out to their boyfriend, their other friends, or whatever. We've even had parents who would share their children, or parents or grandfathers would take them to these clubs or these meetings that they have, and they would pass their granddaughters around to the others. You could take them, it could be just indentured servants where they're working for no pay and no money. But a lot of times it's selling young children, or selling children who are not consenting to have sex with these strange men. And a lot of times they control them with drugs or money or alcohol or silence, or they threaten their lives. And then whenever you some of them may try to run away, and that's how they end up prostituting on the street, because they feel like they just might as well make some money. They're going to get treated like that. But then they work them to death if they're out on the streets in a prostitution ring. So they may live maybe 5 years before they work them to death. Kids, they go through a lot that they don't talk about.
Sure they do. Sure they do. So that must be different than what's called white slavery then, huh?
Not too much.
No?
I mean, no. Well, why do you say white slavery?
Well, that's, I guess that's just a term. It's the characterization of a lot of times women and girls being used as sex slaves and that.
It's becoming more boys than you realize.
Is it really? Okay.
And it has been all along. Just like I said, boys, men didn't talk about it this much because it was, they were told to man up. And so that's created many issues of its own, because they too get into alcohol and drugs to numb that and to deal with that, or become abusive themselves. I know families, whether they're wealthy or not, and they will use their children in bed with them, or they sold their children. I know this well-known watercolor artist out of California. She's phenomenal. Her parents not only used her and sold her, but they told her that she had no talent, and she's an excellent watercolor artist. We've seen where other elderly people have been used and sold by their family to other family members, friends, whatever. And so it goes on. It carries on more than you realize.
Well, look at the two Coreys. They used to be child actors. Corey mm-hmm. Haim and Corey Feldman.
Yeah.
Corey Haim, he probably, if he would have lived any longer, I don't really know if he committed suicide or whether they murdered him, but they were both on this reality show that they had together. I don't even know what it was called now, but the one Corey Haim started alluding to his abuse as a child, and then he was, if he would have lived longer, he probably would have named his abuser, and that would have blown the lid off of Hollywood right there.
And what people don't realize is you're talking to one perpetrator. This perpetrator knows many other perpetrators, and they're doing this as a club or a clique. And whenever you delve, like ICE or whoever, PIs, whoever, they run up on pedophile rings, they think you're just dealing with one person. But whenever they get further into the investigation, they realize it goes deeper and it goes higher up. It goes up to congressmen. It goes from the small house to the White House.
Certainly it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're kind of alluding to the Franklin affair there back in the 70s?
That too, but also I know of another case that's going on right now that we've been assisting with, and that's a pedophile ring that's going on where we're trying to get help for these people.
In Florida?
Georgia.
Georgia, oh, okay. I'd like to get a hold of them people sometime. But I, do you know Jerry Cooper down there in Florida?
No, I don't.
No, he was, he's part of a group called the White House Boys. Well, some of them were survivors and others are victims. Do you remember just about 3 months back that that scandal broke down there in Florida? The 55 boys that were found in graves?
I haven't heard that.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
I don't know how I missed that.
Yeah. That made national headline there. It made national news for like 3 minutes, you know, but there's been like at least 55 boys that have been found down in there, down in Dozier, Florida.
Oh, wow.
Or down there around that vicinity down there. But yeah, Jerry Cooper is part of a group called the White House Boys. I think just a basic search of Jerry Cooper and the White House Boys will get you that story. I had him on just I don't know, 6-7 weeks back, something like that. They're also working on a girls' home down there in Florida that had the same type of abuse. Mm-hmm. It's the White House Boys, well, the Dozier Home for Boys is what it was called. I think it began in like 1900 or 1901 or something like that, and it was finally shut down in either 2008 or 2011, one or the other, but there's been, well, like I said, there's been at least 55 bodies found now, and they're still searching. Some of them survivors are in their 70s and 80s, 60s, yeah. 70s and 80s, and they are thinking that there might be five times that many boys mm-hmm. down there. They just have to look in the right places. Yeah.
That is so sad. Well, how did they finally find him?
I don't recall. Somebody stumbled upon a grave or something, and then they just started digging and finding other things. Something just surfaced. I think it might have been some of the groups down there, just the activism, and finally authorities might have just went digging around and found some bodies.
How about that?
Yeah.
But you know, that happens in all communities all across the nation. It's not just in one particular place. Even though there's a high rate of human trafficking there around Florida, Atlanta, New York, San Francisco, San Diego, Houston, El Paso, Atlanta, Georgia, Oregon. There's like 12 really big hubs, but there's human trafficking all across the United States.
All over the world, too.
Yes.
I recall back late last year that one pedophile ring up there in Toronto got busted.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and there was priests and judges and lawyers and teachers. Yeah. Yeah, you would be surprised.
Yes, there was.
People ask me in my speeches, they say, what does a pedophile look like? And I tell them, a pedophile looks like just like you and I.
It doesn't have a look.
Yeah.
Yeah. Child molesters don't have a look.
Yeah. No, they don't. They're like the person next door.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, I say a lot of times, what does the criminal look like?
Exactly.
Do they shave their heads and wear tattoos, or do they have $5,000 suits and work in Washington, D.C.?
Pretty much both of them. Because, yeah, it's like a robber who will steal many times, but he's only caught once or twice, you know?
Exactly, yeah. I've heard from another advocate, she's a friend of mine, I've had her on a few times, she said child molesters and pedophiles, they don't get caught until like so many times. They might
100 times.
100 times, yeah.
Yeah.
I think she even said 125 times.
Pretty much, yes.
That is, that's astonishing. And that's probably not just one victim either.
Oh, no. That's many. That is very many, and very few will speak about it. You know, we were talking about porn, and we talk about our speeches and our tour, the Shutter and Silence tour. We talk about how some people say a little bit of porn never hurts anything, but that's not true, because I can tell you family after family across the country who are waiting for their daughter to return or their son to return home, but they can't because somebody was watching porn and decided to act upon their inhibitions, and they killed a child and raped them and killed them. Because they've been watching porn. That's not all porn users. Some porn users, you know, but I'm just saying, anytime you delve into something like that, it's not going to get any better. You're going to get to the point where you're going to react upon your inclinations.
Yes. And you always hear the phrase, it is somebody's daughter. You know, I guess you're kind of right, Connie. If there wasn't a porn industry, girls wouldn't get abused like this.
Well, that's true. I know I'm going to, Mark and Cindy Scones out of Sacramento, California, their daughter Courtney is 12. She was coming in from school, and this young guy, his dad was well-to-do in the community, and even told him if he keeps that up, he's going to get caught. He's going to go to jail for this. And so he decided if he's going to go to jail for his porn activity, he's going to act up on it. So he ran across one girl, and she had, I guess, went into her house, and then Courtney was there. So he kidnapped Courtney and raped her and murdered her. And so they don't have dinners or Christmas with Courtney anymore. And there's many families across this country in the U.S. and Canada and all around who are in the same position, you know. And some never know what happens to their children. They're still waiting for them to come home.
Okay. I'm going to bring somebody up that just gave me a message and said he can answer some questions and maybe even, you know, add to the discussion a little bit.
Thank you.
Hi, Billy.
Well, howdy. Good afternoon.
Afternoon. Say hi to Connie.
Hi, Connie.
Hello, Billy. It's a pleasure to meet you.
I can give answer to a few of your questions about the Dozier School of Boys, since I was one of the kids that was kept there back in the 60s.
Wow.
And, an investigation was started in the 70s due to requests by my principal, Horace B. Kinney, and several other parents who had lost kids in the at that school. The state kept on turning down any type of investigation into the questions that were being raised of where these kids had disappeared to, the possibility that there were graves there that were in the old gardens, and so forth. It wasn't until late 90s that parts of the land was being sold off to several vineyards, a couple radio stations, but the subject had been still kept under wrap by the state of Florida, maintaining that it was still an active school and there was nothing wrong going on there, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And in 2007, the school was finally closed. And a production of warrants started giving heed to the legal system, because some of the past lawyers that were involved had died off.
Wow.
And finally the investigation was started, and they hit several of the so-called garden spots.
Mm-hmm.
And with the ground sounding radar.
Oh, wow.
And they started getting good shows of possibility of something buried there.
Well, Billy, let me backtrack a minute. How did the parents, how were they deceived, and what did the school tell them as to why they weren't seeing their children anymore? And what did the parents do?
Well, most of this started back in the early 1900s. And most of these children were brought up from South Florida and out of state. There was no contact with parents back in those days. You have to remember, communications back in the early 1900s through the 40s was very, very limited.
Hmm.
So, and it was just well accepted. If you went to a detention school, you were a goner.
Oh, wow. And the kids knew that going in.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, even into the 60s, we were kept under those situations of fear that we had to do what they wanted us to do, or else we would be out there digging our grave at night. And many a time we got in trouble. That's what they would do. They'd shove us out the door, give us a shovel, and point to a direction, go over there, dig a hole. Then when you got deep enough, when you hit water, they'd make you lay down in that grave or that hole until the sun came up the next morning. And it really, it gave you a massive amount of fear, number one.
Yes.
But your imagination could only run wild. We're talking about 8, 9, 10, 12-year-old boys that have no idea what the world was about.
Wow.
And the influence that the headmaster would give you would be that he was boss. He was beyond the law, and you had to respect that.
Well, if the boys wanted to survive, they were. And I can imagine being in Florida laying in a hole in the middle of the night, because if it's anything like Louisiana, we have vicious alligators and poisonous snakes all over the place.
That's very true. Well, in Florida, you don't have to dig very deep to find water.
That's right.
So these were shallow graves.
Wow.
And, I mean, you'd dig down 3 feet, and that was all you're going to go. And made a barrel. You know, if you're only 3 feet in a hole, those mosquitoes are terrible down there.
Yes, yes, they are. Pack your luggage and they'll take you away on vacation.
Well, Dozier was not a place where you had luggage. You came with your underwear on, and that, and you left with your underwear on.
So, Billy, how did you leave Dozier?
My principal, Horace B. Kinney, saw something in me, and which wasn't a good thing, because it turned into further abuse in my life.
Yeah.
But he saw that I had a certain capability about electronics at a young age. And he pulled me out and put me into a school that I could grow up in.
Thank God for him.
And my it was just so happened my parents were also stationed just outside that school. Mm-hmm. So it brought me back into the family, you might say.
Good.
But what I didn't realize was it was a coordinated effort to indoctrinate me into a system, a military system, that was being abused back in the 60s.
Mm-mm. So you went from one situation to another like most kids do.
Yeah, well, my situation was the fact that I became involved into the government, quote, company.
Mm.
And was part of the MK Ultra.
Oh, wow. That's very sad.
But the real fact of the matter is, we're talking about the abuse that went on. And here's something that I need to make a statement of. These kids that go into these adoptive homes or second homes when they're taken away from their parents.
Yep.
Many times, and I've seen this so many times here in Kansas, they're taken into a mass of adoptive children that are already indoctrinated and already developed abusive personalities.
Yes.
And the older kids live out these abusive traits on the smaller kids.
Yes.
That come into the being. And the abuse is, they know how to negotiate around the house mother or the house father.
Mm-hmm.
If not, the house mother and house father are sometimes part of this abusive trait. And these children become a manipulation of the money source of the state paying out to these homes.
Yeah.
This is a business. This
yes,
is
it is.
A big, big business. These so-called secondary homes for abused children is nothing but a money gate for people making buck over buck over buck.
Yeah, Billy, I got a personal case of my own. I had an uncle and an aunt. They're both deceased now, but back in the late 70s, they took in their grandson and adopted him as their son at the age of like 18 months. And back in the late 70s, they got $800 a month from the system just to raise their grandson.
Well, here in Kansas, we've got a situation at Wichita right now where there are as a adoptive parents who have been receiving money for the last 12 years for a child that disappeared 11 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And they're just now trying to track what happened to this kid. And nobody knows where this kid is. They don't know whether he's dead, alive, if he was a runaway, or what. There's no trace of this child anywhere.
So how come it took 11 years when the CPS is supposed to be doing checks every month or every few months?
That is the question. Everywhere, every state you go, you find the same example of misplaced paperwork or falsified paperwork or falsified statements. And it's all, in some cases, there's kickbacks going to the person that's doing the investigation.
Yes.
And it's just total abuse. And people don't understand how much money is being involved. You're talking about three children in a house at $800 a piece a month. Man, that right there's a... You don't have to work anymore, you know?
And that's the incentives to keep perpetuating the crimes.
That's right. That's right. You hit it right on the top there. Connie.
Yeah, Connie. I can also share another case, too. Charles won't mind me telling, but there's a man out there named Charles Stecker. He's a child advocate. Mm-hmm. He's a survivor. His younger brother, or his older brother, one or the other, did not. Both of them got put into a foster home with a woman that had just 10 months previously killed another boy, and she was still a foster parent, and they put two more boys in there, and his Charles's brother got killed.
Wow.
By this woman, and she never spent a day in jail because she was her family was connected with I guess it was he was Arlen Specter. He ended up being a senator for state of Pennsylvania, but I think he was a top prosecutor back then in them days in the late 60s and that, but he was her family was ended up connected to him, and she never spent a day in jail.
I can believe that, because I can tell you, even today, there the mental attitude toward this situation, towards human trafficking and child sexual assault, is still the same. It's people don't like dealing with it, and they don't like talking about it. And we're still living in 2014.
And as for Stephen, you were mentioning possible reference to your early life, and I can make this statement. Many times, as a very young youngster, I mean, I'm talking about some of us were two, three years old. There were games going on between relatives, your cousins, slightly older. And a lot of these games were playing house, doctor, or dare.
Right.
And if you were ever involved in any one of those three games, you became abused in some way.
Yeah. Well, I've already had one advocate tell me, Billy, that if I suspected that there was some type of molestation, then my suspicions are probably true, and that there probably was.
That's correct.
I mean, it's a wonderful thing that the mind can hide some traumatic situations in the past, because if those things would have followed you through life, it would ruin your life and possibly others around you.
Yeah.
But we have this adaptive way of hiding things. And in my case, part of the MK Ultra thing was compartmentalizing a lot of your personality, where it's always hidden. It's hidden for many years. It's almost like every once in a while you get just a stitch of a dream of your past, and
yeah,
turns out it was true.
That's
true. Especially when you start finding out little things like references to a name or something. And now, and before it was almost impossible to do, but now with the internet around, a name will come through your head, you can write it down, look it up, and all of a sudden, bam, you can find that person and start talking with that person and putting their end with your end and make out what happened.
Start connecting the dots, right?
Yeah, and then you can also connect the dots with the other people that were involved in that same scenario around that same time, like at a home or a group or a club.
Absolutely. I mean, my instance comes back to, I used to be with Kathy O'Brien. In fact, we had a baby together that I have never seen. Until this year, she got to see the baby finally.
Connie may not know who Kathy O'Brien is, though.
I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, she was an abused person within the MK Ultra system, and she was down in Florida, and she was assigned to our house. Our handler at that time was Mark Phillips, and you'll just have to look it up. It's too long for me to go on this program and talk about it. But
okay,
she was manipulated in ways to do just terrible, terrible, terrible things that most women would have never been involved with.
Yeah.
And she became my secondary lover, or my mate. She was more or less assigned. We were assigned together to do jobs together for things that I would do. I would need her the help, you know, and it was, there's so many things missing now out of the relationship that neither one of us could put it together for years until we got together several decades later, and all of a sudden, bam, we knew what was going on. As little things started coming in place, bigger things came in place, And she developed almost total recall, whereas I'm still in question of what, why I was there. How did I get in situations like Ruby Ridge, like Waco, Texas, like Oklahoma City? I still have questions.
So was the person that introduced you to this, was he part of it?
It was Oris Bikini. My principal was part of it.
Oh, wow.
You have to understand, back in those days, they did a selective profiling of young kids
mm-hmm.
who would fit into their program.
Yeah.
And I wound up going to four different schools. I wound up graduating from three different high schools. I can't explain that. It's the government can do weird things to who you are.
Yes, they can.
Okay, well, I've said enough. I'm going to pull back and let Stephen carry on with you.
Well,
I didn't mean to take the show away.
No, that's okay. We've only got about 4 minutes left here, so I don't know. We can go ahead and talk about the mission a little more here, Connie.
Before we do that, I'd like to say one thing to Billy. I know people listening would think, you know, that is so far-fetched because it is so unreal, but I can promise you, I told you I've been on this tour since August 2012. I met some phenomenal people, and I met some survivors who said, like, they were in from the U.S. and they would end up in Canada, and they were at this hospital, and people would think their parents would come to visit them, and they would put them in this room to make them look nice, but after that, it was game on, sort of like you were saying. And they still have a horrific time dealing with those situations. But talking about our program, we've had the Shattering the Silence tour and documentary project. We're filming a documentary, and I'm writing a book, and we're trying to find it by selling the documentary to finish this tour to educate communities and grandparents and parents about the warning signs, safe exit plans, and solutions to provide safer environments for kids, to provide a paradigm shift so it won't be such a taboo subject and, you know, we can shatter the silence. We'd like to continue and take those funds when we do sell the documentary, the book, and we'd like to run on a green platform and open up centers for abused women and children. So we'll see how well that works out. We'd like for them to stay for a year and become educated and business owners and get them out of those toxic situations and provide them with opportunities for better lives for them, for their children as well. So that's where we're going with our program, and I thank you for having us.
Okay, yeah, absolutely great. It's been a wonderful time. We still got 2 minutes here, so I'm going to, well, just one last question here, Connie. What do you...
Yes.
Do you ever feel like when you're giving a talk or a presentation, you ever feel like going down in the crowd and smacking somebody, smacking everybody in the back of the head and say, listen, this is our children. We have to protect them.
Well, what we do is we like to do some dramatics at the end. I've incorporated this drama thing that I've designed, program I've designed called Cries of the Nation. And we like for people, it's just a really short skit, but it's very powerful. And we like for people, and we do a rendition of Honor, because the five children die a day to the child's sexual assault, abuse, and neglect. And we do an honor thing for them. And we try to bring it home, and we try to pass the torch on to them and say, this is, you know, the children tell me thank you for touring across the country and telling their stories and thank you for fighting for them. But now I'm passing the torch on to you. I'm saying this is not our generation. We're going to stand up and we're going to fight. We're going to do it together. No longer will we sit away in indifference. No longer will we stand away and say this is not, you know, none of my business. But we're going to stand up and we're going to fight for the kids. We're going to say we've heard your cries through the night. We're here for you. We're fighting for you. No longer will I sit by in silence. Today I'm on your side and I'm fighting for you. And then we add a few more things into that, but that's pretty much how we close out our program.
Well, certainly. Yeah, and just one last thing, too. There was another man I had on last year. His name is David Scherter. He was a survivor of that Nebraska, the Franklin Affair is what it was mm-hmm. called. That ritualistic ring out there that... molested, well, more or less raped boys and girls, and then ritualistically sacrificed them.
Yes.
But I thank you for coming on, Connie.
Thank you. I'm familiar with both of those names that you mentioned, and
are
I
you?
Do know them, so thank you.
Okay.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Bill.
All right, thank you, Connie. Thank you for coming on. We're going to continue on. Billy and another guest are going to stay on after the break here. So,
thank you, Stephen, for having us.
Okay, Connie, thank you. We'll be right back.